Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and this evening we have some very, very powerful information for you, and we're going to deliver this from every conceivable angle possible. What we want to let you know is, in the beginning, we are offering our free articles to 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and Secrets of America. You really need to have this information in your possession. It's very, very powerful and informative information. And I also want to say congratulations to the Moors today. All over the country, I've been getting phone calls all day long from Moors that's having a tremendous amount of success using the materials that's in Tahaka's archives. We had one sister, she's gone up in the court and just turned the whole courtroom upside down up in there using these tools. The way to access that is hit me up at the Tahaka Archives at TAHAKAARCHIVES.org and get your archives. And as soon as you do, contact me so that we can go to work and I can point exactly what to put, what to do, what documents to use, what to study, so you'll know how to defend your position in regards to your mortgage company, student loans, bill collectors, your light and water company. It doesn't really matter. Law firms, the police, traffic stops, it doesn't matter what it is. And you'll be able to have access to that information, and you will have a coach. So you're not in this thing by yourself. As soon as you access that, call me, and I'll walk you through this thing step by step. And we work on it until we get it done. You do your estate. You can set up your estate. A lot of us don't have a will, and we can show you how to put that together and put it where it will work properly. Because usually when you give an attorney and you tell an attorney you want to do your will, what he'll do is he'll do that will up and he'll take it and put it in a file cabinet, but he won't file it into that court record until you're dead. You don't need it while you're dead. You need it when you're living. So contact me, Tahaka, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Stay tuned for tomorrow's broadcast and definitely be here for Thursday's broadcast. The Grand National Chairman of the Moorish American Government will be with us, and we'll be dropping some information on the history of the church, all the background information, all the nuts and bolts and wiggle pins on the whole situation. Okay? Now, we want to start off by saying, talking about this survival thing. The first thing that we have to consider, if you notice how the title is written about Moorish nationhood, and that is very, very important for us to understand, because we're going to have to start, in order to survive this thing, we're going to have to start acting collectively. We're going to have to start effectively. And when you start doing that, then you're well on your way to actually building something. And that's what it's going to actually take inside the country to get the job done. But we have to look at what we are up against inside the United States. We are people that have been deprived of a nationality. We have been labeled, everybody on the planet has a nationality except us. We keep thinking that we don't need one. It's not that important. I can do that tomorrow. I'll start working on that tomorrow, and then, of course, when tomorrow comes, the next day, the next day, the next day. You have to understand this is something that's extremely important. You have to have that to be recognized. Nobody on the planet knows you. Nobody recognizes you. Who are you? We don't know anything about colored people, or Negroes, or black people. We don't know anything about that. Who are these people? Nobody knows anything about you. So you have to recognize who you are, do the research so that you will be able to explain who you are based on the facts that you can provide to anyone who's curious enough to want to know. This is extremely important for us to do if we hope to survive as a nation. We have to connect to our story. Everybody is connected to their story. The Mexicans are connected to their story. The Puerto Ricans, they're connected to their story. Chinese, Japanese, Indian people in the country called India, all of these people are connected to their story. But when it comes to us, we have all these fragmentations going on. We got this, I'm black today, I was colored Negro, Afro-American yesterday, and African-American the day before that. We got to put some of that to the side, okay? Well, actually, all of it to the side. We got to realize that all people on the planet and all races on the planet has a nationality. Everybody got one. And when we start realizing the importance of nationhood, then we can get on with construction and building things, okay? We got to do it.
Let me go to Dr. Naeem Akbar. He's yelling, I ain't coming behind that. Well, somebody's got to. And it ain't going to be me because I'm just asking questions. What Dick Gregory's talking about in his legendary brilliance. That's what I said earlier, that conscious comedy that makes us think about the issues that we have to wrestle with inside of Black America to reclaim our democracy, to recast our future. That's what Dick Gregory's talking about. Reclaiming our democracy and recasting our future in his own brilliant way. It does, though, raise the question, Dr. Akbar, Dick's stand-up, if you will, raises the question that we hit at earlier today in the first panel, but haven't gotten into this panel as we start to move now toward our closing statements after this comment, as this answer, rather, of what we do, never mind Barack Obama and what may come, never mind Hillary Clinton and what may come, the pride that women and people of color will take one way or the other. What do we do about the miseducation of our young people?
Right.
We're looking for a new story to tell them. We're trying to reclaim our democracy. We're trying to recast our future. And yet, in the midst of all of that, we still have to educate these babies.
Yeah.
What do we do then about the miseducation ongoing still, no matter who gets elected? That ain't going to stop overnight, the miseducation of our people.
All I can say is all been said. But anyway, the reality is, and I think that one of the things that I always come to at this point in these discussions is to understand it's not an issue of either or, but it is both and. That is that we have to be unrelenting in demanding that the democracy do what it says it ought to do. But simultaneously, we have to be unrelenting in recognizing that we have done the impossible. A part of the miseducation is the failure to recognize the strength of our resilience, the strength of our transcendence, the power that we've had to operate in spite of all that America has done. We still too often feel that we must go to them to ask permission to be us. We still think we have to ask authorization whether or not we can tell our story our way. We still think that we can only build the America that we want by getting permission from them to have access to make it what we want it to be. The reality of it is that we, America, wouldn't be what it is had we not taken the initiative and the prerogative to make it our way despite what they wanted us to do. With the issue of miseducation, I hold my primary belief is that our greatest sense, our greatest disempowerment has been the systematic effort to make us unconscious of our conscious power. That somehow we don't know our real power. We don't know who we are. I think that Carter G. Woodson raised that issue 70 years ago when he talked about the miseducation of the Negro, and he talked about the fact that there was a systematic omission and distortion of our absence in terms of world history. I believe that W.E.B. Du Bois has talked about it in terms of not recognizing that we are a part of those who structure not only civilization on this planet, not only in a universal way, but also in terms of being the element that has made America, America. What we have to understand that America will never be able to survive as America until we begin to understand what it is and who it is that we are. The only way we can do that is to begin to tell our story. We have to begin to tell our story systematically. We have to sing our own heroes. We have to sing our own sheroes. We cannot wait for people to somehow authorize us to celebrate who we are. We have to be proud to be who we are, be unapologetic about who we are, and to understand that America and the world will never be what it can be until we understand our own power within ourselves. So, yeah, let's hold America accountable. Let's hold the White House accountable. Let's hold Congress accountable. Let's call the presidency accountable. But most of all, let's hold ourselves accountable to our grandmamas and our granddaddies and to all those people who've made a difference and have transformed this place and has transformed this world. So we got to tell the story. I've spent 30 years telling our psychological strength because everything in psychology said we ain't worth a damn. It said we were psychologically incompetent, said we were paranoid schizophrenic, said we had ADHD, said we were intellectually incompetent, intellectually incapable, and we've been able to go in institutions where nobody mentioned anything about us, mastered everything in the institution, came back, critiqued it, deconstructed it, and rewrote our own story our way. And if that ain't genius, what the hell is genius? And until we understand that, we'll never get there. So let's sing our story and be happy about it.
Dr. Naeem Akbar, I'm going to give him 30 seconds to catch his breath, and then we're going to start our round of our last round of closing comments. And I'd like, again, I don't want to color this in too much, but I want to give the panelists the flexibility they need to answer the question. But I know that today, as we wrap up this second and final panel, that if there is one thing that we all agree on in this room and across Black America, and on this stage especially, it is that your vote is your voice. Your vote is your voice. And I want to offer this as the extra question. We'll start with Dr. Akbar for a brief closing thought and work our way down to the other end. What do you say, Dr. Akbar, to this audience, to those watching around the country, about voting their conscience? Our job today has been, as we said earlier, to try to prick your conscience by raising these issues, by having this deliberative space.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the reason I played that is because I wanted Dr. Naeem Akbar to deliver
some information that we should really, really take to heart involving who we are. It stands to reason, I've said this over and over, if we build the greatest civilization on the planet, there's no reason in the world why we can't do it again. All we have to do is change our mind. It all happens right there in your brain. And this is why I do the things that I do. This is why I present the shows that I do. This is why I send you the free articles and everything else to go along with that, so that you can get a new look at what's going on, so that you will know what you're up against and what you need to do. We got to do this. We got a situation where a gentleman exposed corrupt judges in the United States. And when he exposed one, they want to put him in jail. They want to block him. They want to try to do all this thing because he is telling about the corruption. We live in a lawless society. We live in a corrupt society. And what you're going to do, and especially us, we're going to have to take responsibility for ourselves. We're going to have to start using the talents that our Creator has given us to make the necessary changes in our lives. We have to do that. We cannot continue to do the things that we've been doing and hoping by some hook or crook something's going to change. It's not going to change until you make something change. That's just the bottom line. And when we understand
that, I think that if you observe what happens to many young people in the African community right now, is that many of them are literally raising themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The formal social organization, formal involvement in churches and organizations that take sustained periods of time, led by knowledgeable senior adults to tell people what they need to know, to provide them with a value system, to give them legitimation and so forth, the tightness of the structure that makes that happen has weakened considerably. And so what you see is children that are basically raising children, and that's unfortunate. But every group should have that structure to socialize its children.
So, again, I ask you the question. Let me restate it. Where did we lose it, and how did we lose it? Because it was there before. Everybody, Dr. Akbar, everybody tells the story of Miss Mary down the street who could whoop you, and you got another whipping when you got home. We had that. People in our generation certainly had it. Where did we lose it? Within one generation?
Well, it's been clear that it's been under siege ever since we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like we, and what we had in many ways was an adaptation to conditions that were constantly threatening the lives of our families. And because we were clear about our shared oppression, if you will, I mean, we were forced into a cage where we had no doubt that our condition was one that was undesirable. We wanted to get out of that cage. Once desegregation came along, once we began to get this illusion of freedom, freedom because we were now able to live in other people's reality, then we began to give up the perception, the shared perception that we had a shared kind of threat going on. And as a result of that, we lost a lot of the adaptive things that kept us surviving. So I think that began to deteriorate those forces that worked to preserve the integrity of how we raised our children, preserved our families.
You also have to realize that there are things that are done to us that weaken our capacity to sustain our institutions.
Such as?
Job discrimination, the decline of educational opportunities, Hollywood propaganda, negative images about African people.
Okay, let's try to look at some of those. Mm-hmm. And you, Dr. Akbar, you mentioned one, the illusion of inclusion. Some of us have made it, so to speak. We have nice homes, nice cars, and are taking care of our families. We don't share that problem with other people. And if you just work a little harder, it could happen to you, too. What do you think?
Well, I think that's it. I really believe that there's been a tremendous push to confuse inclusion with actual power. In other words, we confuse presence with power. And therefore, we've willingly exchanged the opportunity to be in the presence of powerful people for real aspiration to power. So once upon a time, we wanted to have our own business in our own communities. Once upon a time, we had a commitment to building colleges that reflected the unique perspectives that we had on reality. But once we were given access to be in the presence of those who had real power, we gave up our own, seeing theirs as being more legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Both of you have mentioned education or educational institutions. How have they, and I've heard educators talk about how they are destroying our youth today, how have they done that, or do you agree that they have?
Well, educational institutions are having a difficult time educating all the children, but especially for us. And for example, one of the things that's happened in the last 12 to 15 years, 1980, 12% of the teaching force in this country was African.
Do you think that's done on purpose? Is that by intent?
Well, it's a combination of things. Some of it by intent, some of it by the structure of the institutions. For example, if you use the National Teachers Examination as a selection device for teachers, you will pick people who can score high and can't teach. And you will eliminate people who can and have been teaching who don't score high.
Okay, you raise
what do you call that, intentional or non-intentional?
You raise a critical issue in test taking. How do you determine somebody's going to do well on a job, be it a teacher, a paramedic, a police officer, or anything else, if you don't have some bar of measurement? And how do we determine what bar of measurement is fair, Dr. Akpa?
Well, I think the best bar of measure is prior performance. I mean, that is clearly the best predictor of future performance is prior performance. So, for an example, it has clearly been demonstrated by all kinds of tests that people have done that the best predictor of student performance in college is high school performance of those students. Like how well they've done. Have they gone to class? Have they attended to doing their studies? And how they have performed is the best indicator. However, the tests are really one of the poorer indicators. But because the people who control the test also control the gateway, they use the test as a means to affirm the decisions they've already made. So there's a kind of like a predetermined selectivity that they simply use the test as a means of labeling to keep out rather than to include.
Yet and still, let's say that all of that is true, and I do believe you. How do you determine if a person is going to be a good police officer or a good paramedic if they have no prior determination in that field?
Well, I think that one of the things you do is require them to have some prior determination in terms of activity related to that. What has been their relationship with people prior to that time? So how have they dealt with authority positions? I'm sorry.
I just testified in a Supreme Court case for police, sergeant's exam in New York City. And it was very interesting to me that you usually get more interest in paper and pencil tests when you get more black applicants. Prior to that, people are much more lackadaisical about what tests mean and what they do. Well, one of the things that I asked was that if you wanted to find out whether these were really good tests or not, let's give the test to the people who are holding the jobs now, and let's find out how that compares to their performance rating.
And what was the answer to that?
Well, they didn't think they wanted to do that.
I wonder why.
You see, I mean, there's a lot of common sense things that let you know that Dr. Akbar said is that testing is more of a gatekeeping function. It's not a quality control device for guaranteeing quality.
Well,
it looks as if on the face of it, it looks to be that way, but it isn't.
Well, it sounds like we need to revamp what we think of education. There used to be things that were called apprenticeships. If you were going to become a shoemaker, you worked at at the feet of someone who was an expert at it, and they taught you, and you knew if you had an aptitude for it or not. Could we not return to those things for police officers, for doctors, lawyers, whatever?
Most people are looking for something quick, dirty, and cheap. And so a paper and pencil test is quick and dirty. It's a statement about how much the society is willing to invest in developing and in assessing talent. But what you call for an apprenticeship is labor intensive. People would much prefer to be able to make a decision in a 15-minute span, based on a 15-minute or an hour test, than to take a 3-week or 4-week internship. So what you're really looking for is a quick way to make a dirty decision.
Okay, we're back. One thing that I want to put out there, first of all, if any of you have any questions or comments, you can raise your hand at any given point in time from here on in to the end of this broadcast, we'll recognize your hand, and you can make your comment, ask your question. But we need to recognize, and I look at the situation this way. I approach things with common sense. I observe when they say, well, such and such a company has laid off 5,000 workers, and the company itself is going to another country. That's 5,000 people unemployed. Then another company comes along and lay off another 30,000 people. That company leaves the country and go get cheap labor from somewhere else. So now we have all these people unemployed, but then we have these so-called statistic experts come on and say, well, employment inside the United States is moving steadily upward. How can it move steadily upward when we get lost over 60,000 people for unemployment? What are you talking about? As long as we're continuing to eat from this type of rhetoric, we will remain in the same posture that we're always in. We're continuing to tell our children to go to school, get a good education, so they can get a job. Where is that? I'm not going to tell you not to go to school to get a good education, because whatever talents you have, you may need some skills. I'm not going to tell you to go there to get it. But what I'm trying to tell you is the Creator has given all of us talents to be self-sustaining. All you have to do is open your mind, recognize what they are, use these talents, and realize what you are supposed to do as a people in spite of what everybody else is doing for their own personal survival. We got people all over the country just setting up their communities and being self-sustaining. They're keeping their money in their communities. Okay, you do the same thing, but you cannot do it as a scattered people without any knowledge. You're going to have knowledge to do it. That's the bottom line. And you'll be more effective when you can start thinking on a collective basis. When you start thinking collectively, someone asks you, when they see five or six men and women come together, well, they want to know who's your leader. Well, there's no leader. All of us have one mind. And there's about 35 more of us, 150 more of us with the same mindset. You see, that's how you remedy a lot of situations. There's nobody for you to isolate and injure. There's no minds that you can misdirect unless you're going to try to misdirect millions at the same time. Now, you're already doing it through the media, but we're waking up to that. We're learning that we are valuable, and the first person that decided we are valuable is us. And when we get that stuff under our belt and start thinking that way, then we are become a force to be reckoned with. We can start building our communities with cooperation between one another. We can start putting our little small idiosyncrasies to the side and our little squabbles to the side and realize that we are in a struggle for survival inside the United States as a people. We're going to have to do that. There's no way for us to survive without it. That's just the bottom line.
What you're really looking for is a quick way to make a dirty decision.
And the other thing is, we really have to keep in mind that people who hold power want to maintain power. And they are not going to do anything. You see, one of the reasons that the whole argument about affirmative action is such a necessary argument is that this society has demonstrated itself to not have a moral conscience. It doesn't do what's right. Neither does it even do what's correct. And therefore, if you don't enforce some kind of correct behavior, this society will not act correctly. And the behavior of whites, European Americans, towards African Americans throughout our history here has been incorrect, immoral, and wrong.
So morality cannot be legislated, but behavior
correct action can
be regulated.
You can make them act right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing. So my point is that very often we get into kind of debates and dialogues arguing as if it's a logical process. It is not logical. It was not intended to be logical. And the objective is to maintain brute power and control over limited limited resources that they want to maintain for themselves, other people want to maintain for themselves.
Okay, you mentioned brute power, limited control in educational institutions, which makes my mind focus on the prison system, where almost a million black men languish across this nation. People say, well, if they hadn't done crime, they shouldn't have to worry about doing the time. How do you respond to why there are so many black men in prison, Dr. Akbar?
Well, it continues exactly what I said. I think it's a definition of power. And certainly, if you can begin to corral the manpower of a community, you can certainly keep them out of the competition for genuine power. You know, therefore, one of the things I think that is probably one of the most dangerous ideas going on in the nation today is the proposal by the Black Leadership Summit of Ben Shavis and Minister Farrakhan of a million black men marching on Washington.
You think that's a dangerous idea?
It's dangerous for white America.
It's dangerous for them,
you see, because it is black men defining an agenda for themselves which precludes them having the kind of influence that the prison gives them optimally, you see. Now, my point is that the prison system minimizes the ability for self-determination. And it is clearly a system that does nothing corrective. No one has been able to demonstrate that prisons reduce crime. No one has been able to demonstrate that the men who go to prison come out more able to serve and operate in the community. In fact, just the opposite is more typically demonstrated. But again, that's why I say the only reason that people would make those kinds of illogical decisions is because that's not the question. The question is not who is doing wrong. The question is how can we control certain segments of the population. Who do you want to control? Look at the population statistics in the prison and you'll find out who wants to control. Who does the controlling? Look at the people who are making the decisions about building more prisons. And who works there? Who makes the money from it? Who does the research? And who therefore gets the returns and the rewards from that? And then you know who has the power and what is the purpose for having that
prisons
power.
Prisons and building them are a growth industry.
It's a growth industry.
The United States.
Yes. Running them as well.
Let me give a concrete example of what Dr. Akbar is talking about. I just saw numbers on imprisonment for crack cocaine. Now everybody knows there's a difference between the powder and the crack. But this is crack, and comparing whites who use crack and blacks who use crack. The whites who use crack are almost never tried in federal court.
Because it's a federal offense, the mandatory 5 years?
Or? Because you go to prison more if you try it in the federal system. I just saw this write-up, and the numbers, the gap was just so startling that it couldn't be anything other than racism in operation. But that's just one example of the inequity in the justice system that results in what is now seven times higher number of black men in prison than in South Africa. And the prescription that the way to fix the problem in the communities now is to build more prisons. But not only to build more prisons, but if you read the Bell Curve book, they suggest that they've got to put only certain types of people in these prisons and there's going to be more of them. And then some of the lesser crimes, those people will be incarcerated in camps. And then there'll still be people incarcerated with electronic bracelets in something that they're calling neighborhood arrest. Now the numbers are going to be astronomical if that public policy recommendation is followed, and apparently it will be, because those men are the ones that hang out with the ultra right wing conservatives who are making these same kinds of proposals with maybe just a little bit milder language.
So I go back to one of my original questions. We've gathered all this data. How do we reverse all that is happening to our people with this knowledge?
First of all, let's not minimize the importance of the word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people like to call it rhetoric. People like to say it's just talking. Talking is the foundation for re-education. So this program, this format, having this opportunity is so limited. The amount of talk show hours that occur on television are overwhelming. And the amount of garbage and trash that gets talked is overwhelmingly limited, in a higher proportion than the kind of talk like this that goes on. So number one is to get a new kind of information to our people. Let's begin to tell them another story. And the story that we are talking about in terms of self-affirmation is a critical way to begin to counter that. As well, it helps let our people become more conscious of what happens in warfare. and how we are at war and people are fighting to destroy us. We need to teach that so that people will understand that it's not RoboCop who is our enemy. It is Charles Murray who's writing a book defining us as being intellectually inferior who is our enemy. It's the people who are selecting comedians and buffoons to put on TV rather than selecting our scholars to begin to tell us something about where we can go. I'm sorry, Dr.
Dr. Hillier.
I can't say it any better than that.
Okay. All right. Then let me take another tack on this. We always talk about our young people and what's wrong with our young people, but what's wrong with our elders today? It seems to me it's the elders' responsibility to reach back and teach the young people what we already know.
I think elders need socialization just as much as the children do, especially those who missed what they ought to have had. And then I think elders need information. You know, many of our people don't have the kind of information that we're sharing right here, right now. So they have no sense of the depth of the problem, the nature of the siege that Dr. Akbar was talking about. And so if you look at the behavior of people who have means, sometimes degrees, bank accounts, and so forth, you look at their behavior, you would swear that everything is just perfect because their behavior reflects no attention to the crisis that we're in. But given what we just got through talking about, just take the prison thing alone, the socialization of our kids alone, these are critical things. And if we're not mobilized to address those, and we are the only ones that will address those, no one else will come into our communities and fix that problem other than us.
Even though the physical realities of slavery were over 130 years ago, the bottom line is that psychologically, not only do we still suffer from the duress of that condition, we also have behavioral patterns that were established during that time that persist. And as with any other thing that whereby we change our behavior, is that it must be preceded by awareness. If we don't know it, we can't change it. Let's decide that we want to stop acting like slaves, and let's understand that when we tear each other down, when we can't come together as a community, when we begin to see work as something that services other people and not ourselves, that's not normal. That's how slaves act. Do you want to be a slave? Well, stay on the plantation. I want to get free.
All right. On that note, we'll close it out. I thank you, gentlemen, both for being here.
You've
been very enlightening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I thank you for being with us also. I'm Chris Moore. Bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. I want to say something about our society that we live in. We go through life day to day, and we look for the sunshine and the rain. And the only thing that we want is peace and tranquility. And we are go to the same places, we go to the same stores, we see the same people who are taking our money and giving us their products, and we do this in and out day after day after day after day. And as long as nothing happens, we all right. We just want to be left alone. Just leave me alone. Don't break in my house. Don't hurt my children. Just let me have peace. If I can just have one day of peace, I'm fine. But what we're going to have to realize is that we, as people of African descent inside the United States, the Moors, are under a national assault, a national attack. Regardless of how clear the sky is, if there were no ambulance sounds you heard yesterday, that doesn't matter because the attack is still there. It hasn't gone away. We had to recognize this. When you walk around the corner in your neighborhood and you see somebody occupying a store other than you, taking money from you and giving you an inferior product, then whether it's superior or inferior, it doesn't really matter. If it's not you behind that counter, then you have a problem in your neighborhood. And this thing is going on across this country. We don't hear on a daily basis all the people and all the situations and all the attacks that's going on across this country involving our people. Because there is a system set up where we're only going to give you small portions of isolated information unless we rank it as something that everybody's supposed to know about. And even at that, we're going to water that down. You see, our people are being incarcerated all over the country at an alarming rate. They're being murdered. They're being imprisoned. They're being robbed. This is an attack against a specific species of people, and it just happens to be us. So we're going to have to understand this from that perspective. It doesn't matter how good the weather is outside, how nice the people in your community are when you go to do shopping with them, you have to realize that they are in the wrong place and the place that they're in that you should be in. And you got to change your thinking. You're going to have to take responsibility nationally on an individual basis, thinking nationally and collectively to change your circumstances to avoid or survive this international attack against people of African descent. I'm laying the statistics out for you tonight so that you can see what's going on. We want to identify the problem. We're going to come back with part two and get down into the nuts and bolts of wiggle pins of what to do where you are. But right now, we want to deal with this thing from this perspective. We have to understand that we all we got. We got nobody else. Nobody recognizes us. Nobody outside the United States understand nothing or know nothing about no Negro, cuss, and blacks. Don't know nothing about it. Don't know nothing about us. Nobody's going to come to the rescue. You have to save yourself. You have to do all these things for yourself because we all we got.
Oh, you're medicine for my tooth when it aches. Like a handyman, you fix my heart when it breaks.
know, I get a lot of calls from around the country from people talking about someone trying to nationalize them, sell them documents for thousands of dollars, and they take the documents and file them in the court, and they're still going to jail and all of this kind of stuff, and it doesn't make any sense. We have designed a system whereby not only can you get what you need as far as the documents, and you get a perfect understanding about your nationality and culture and all of that stuff, but we're going to walk you through this thing step by step. What I need you to do is go to taharkaarchives.org. That's TaraHaka.org. And as soon as you do that, contact me, Taharka Amana L. Bay, at area code 904-303-9061. And always try to contact me before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You know, I do the radio broadcast and stuff of that nature. And we had to run a gym, too. So call me, 904-303-9061. Go to Taharka Archives at TaraHaka Archives.org. That's it.
My being in jail for 1 year and possibly longer should show you that nobody is immune from this abuse of power.
Dr. Richard I. Fine spent 18 months in jail to demonstrate how corrupt the California justice system really is. We'll show you what he uncovered next on Full Disclosure.
Relentless, probing, fearless. This is Emmy Award-winning Full Disclosure with Leslie Dutton, bringing you the truth by revealing the news behind the news.
Hello, I'm Leslie Dutton. Full Disclosure has spent the better part of the last 2 years bringing to light the alarming problems with the California judicial system. Being the news behind the news, we've spent dozens of hours documenting the sinister encroachment of county governments as they move to control the local judiciary for their benefit. As you will see in this four-part series, this insidious encroachment is threatening the entire justice system, where the essence of a fair trial is being lost forever. This is the story of Dr. Richard I. Fine. It's just one account of this disturbing abuse of power. Our story begins with this first interview with Dr. Fine on March 3, 2009, the day before he was to face Los Angeles Superior Court Judge David Yaffe and a charge of contempt of court. When we asked him if he was fearful, he became quite philosophical.
Tomorrow's hearing is interesting because the challenges that I've had before are basically challenges that we can say work within a functioning system. I mean, when I was getting all of this money back and so forth, I was dealing with a system that was functional. I mean, you have a case, you go into a court, it either gets settled, you win it, or you lose it, and you're dealing with a system that has integrity. Tomorrow's case, or the case that we have now, is dealing with a dysfunctional system because of the fact that this is now pure politics and retaliation.
We asked him to explain why Judge Yaffe is charging him with contempt of court.
He's found me in contempt for refusing to answer questions from a commissioner about an illegal order that he has made. And he wants to sentence me to jail until I answer those questions. Now, I have gone to the Court of Appeal with what is known as a writ of habeas corpus, which means bring in the body. And I have asked the Court of Appeal to enter a stay stopping Judge Yaffe from doing anything. I haven't heard yet as of today whether they've entered that stay or not. If they enter the stay, Judge Yaffe is dead in his tracks. If they don't enter the stay, then I'll go into the California Supreme Court. And if the California Supreme Court doesn't enter the stay, then I'll go into the United States District Court. Sooner or later, I will win.
He had no comprehension of the price he was about to pay. We asked him why it was so important to stand up to Judge Yaffe.
Every year, the county, as part of its budget, under what is known as trial court funding, if you look in the budget, you'll actually see this. Under trial court funding, you will see money going to the judges. And that money in this particular year is approximately $20 million or $46,370-some-odd per judge.
He explained that the payments were wrong from the beginning, and that both the county and the judges understood this, yet they did it anyway.
They knew at that point in time that they couldn't do this. They knew that to do this was illegal because under the California Constitution, under what is known as Article 6, Section 19 of the California Constitution, only the state legislature could prescribe the compensation of the judges.
If the state constitution was clear that only the state could pay the judges, we could only surmise that why the county was paying extra money to the judges.
That basically the county was buying judges?
The bottom line of it is yes, because the only reason that the county could be giving this money, the only underlying reason, is that the county had cases in front of these judges. The county is a major litigant in the California courts. And it's the same thing as if Tony Soprano had been giving money to the judges. In fact, the county has an average, as far as normal cases are concerned, when I say normal, that's excluding child custody cases, that's excluding criminal cases, just taking your regular cases, the county has about 700 to 800 new cases a year in the Superior Court. So when the county is giving this money, the underlying thought, in my opinion, is that the county wanted to influence the judges to decide the cases in the county's favor.
But is there any proof that the county's investment in these judges pays off?
We have documents from the county council to the Board of Supervisors that shows that in the year 2005 and in the year 2006 and 2007, not one case that was decided by an L.A. Superior Court judge was decided against the County of Los Angeles. So basically, nobody won in that period of time. And for the year 2007-2008, in that fiscal year, the documents are a little bit more vague, and possibly two cases were decided by a judge against the County of Los Angeles.
So even though it violates the Constitution, paying off the judges has had a significant financial benefit for the county.
Do you believe that the individual judges are aware of what they've been doing is illegal?
Absolutely. There's no question that they knew that it was illegal. These people aren't like you or I, you know, that are unaware of the law. These are judges. These are people that are supposed to uphold the law. They have a code of judicial ethics that makes them liable and makes them aware that they have to uphold the integrity of the court. They have to obey the laws of the California. They have taken an oath to obey the law of the state of California. They have taken an oath to obey the law, the Constitution of the United States of America, and the laws of the United States of America. And under Article 6, Clause 2 of the United States Constitution, they are bound to obey the law, the Constitution of the United States, and the laws of the United States. There is no question whatsoever that they knew that they were taking illegal money. None whatsoever. They knew the California Constitution. They knew that the Constitution said that only the state could prescribe their compensation. They knew that they're state elected officials. They knew that they're state employees. They knew that they weren't working for the county. And they knew that this money was illegal. And they took it. No way that they can get around that.
On Tuesday, March 4th, he walked into the courtroom and stood defiantly in front of Judge Yaffe, who held him in contempt. He was cuffed and escorted by half a dozen sheriff's deputies directly to the notorious Los Angeles Central Men's Jail. There was no trial, no conviction. And as we found out over the next year and a half, no appeal. We're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll show you how Dr. Fine continued his fight against the system while incarcerated in solitary coercive confinement. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Full Disclosure in part one of our four-part series, The Cost of Courage, the story of Richard I. Fine.
We had the honor of interviewing a former Los Angeles Sheriff Deputy, Sergeant Richard Valdemar. Sergeant Valdemar spent several years working in custody within the Los Angeles jails. He shared with us what Dr. Fine was enduring and the hazards of being an enemy of the system.
You know, when you're in custody, you're at the mercy of the authorities that have placed you in custody. We have good deputies, but we've also had bad deputies that take advantage of the fact that you're, you know, without, first of all, you're hidden from public view, and the circumstances of the jail are very sparse and very difficult to for anyone to endure. So if I just a little bit of effort on my part as a deputy could make your stay there intolerable. And, you know, unfortunately, we have to discipline deputies for that kind of thing. And I have actually seen people do that, taking advantage of the inmates. So I'd be concerned for Mr. Fine's, you know, condition now and being exposed to the wrong kind of people, making the system angry at him. You know, this could be dangerous.
But Dr. Fine wasn't just lying around playing cards with the other inmates. He was vigorously fighting to win back his freedom. He first filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus on March 20th, but his writ was initially ignored until it was finally denied on May 5th, months later. He explained what happened in a phone call from his cell in the L.A. jail.
A magistrate judge immediately started breaking the law. Under the law, the law is 28 United States Code Section 2243, upon receiving the writ, the petition for the writ, he had to either issue the writ, and the exact words are forthwith, or she had to issue an order to show cause to the respondent, who was the sheriff, forthwith.
The term forthwith is a legal term meaning immediately, promptly, and without delay. The denial from Magistrate Worley didn't deny his petition until May 5th, 46 days later.
And the magistrate judge has gone through and has violated the law, the 28 U.S.C. Section 2243, on all the counts that I have mentioned. So I should have been out of here as early as probably April 12th.
This phone call was recorded on June 30th, 10 weeks later.
But it gets even worse, because in reading her document, I came to realize that she had not even read the entire petition. In the order to show cause, it showed that I was criminally charged under Business and Professions Code Section 6126 for practicing law and holding myself out to practice law. And that was a criminal charge with a sentence of up to 1 year in jail. She claimed that charge didn't exist, which indicates that she had not even read the order to show cause. So I knew that she hadn't read either the transcript of January 22nd, 2009, nor had she read the minute order of January 22nd, 2009, and nor had she read the papers that I filed in the California Court of Appeal or the California Supreme Court, and nor had she read the exhibits to the petition.
For our viewers' sake again, I'd like you to explain, why is it you are representing yourself?
Well, I'm representing myself because of the fact that we could not find any lawyer that has experience in this area who had the courage to represent me in this case. Writ of habeas corpus, you have effectively gone through and removed about 1,600 Superior Court judges in California. And you've definitely removed all of the 430 Superior Court judges here in L.A. County. But the interesting thing is that these judges have already thrown in the towel by not having contested the petition.
Mr. Fine is adamant that L.A. Superior Court Judge Yaffe, Magistrate Judge Carla Worley, and Los Angeles Sheriff Leroy Baca are illegally keeping him in confinement.
Any way that you look at this petition for writ of habeas corpus, you know, I should have been out of here a long time ago.
A writ of habeas corpus demands that a party be released or the custodial authority demonstrate a reason for continued incarceration. The lack of response by either the sheriff or the superior court gave Dr. Fine additional ammunition in his fight to get free. No one in authority responded to the issues in his petition. So technically speaking, are they opposing his release?
The answer to that is no, because none of them opposed any of the grounds or the claims or the facts in the petition.
Well, how could this happen, that there's... It appears that none of them are having any regard for the statutes or the rules.
Then you're absolutely correct. All of them, at this point in time, the sheriff, the L.A. Superior Court, the sheriff violated the law by not giving reasons for my being in here and also didn't respond to the petition at all. And the L.A. Superior Court and Judge Yaffe, in a sense, violated the law by not directly responding to the petition, and also did not answer any of the grounds, the facts, or the claims, and did not oppose anything in the petition. So right now, it turns out that the sheriff, the L.A. Superior Court, and Judge Yaffe have basically thrown in the towel. So they're not opposing anything.
According to Dr. Fine, by not refuting his arguments in his petition, Dr. Fine would win by default. That would mean that they had no grounds to continue holding him. That's according to the law. But he remained in jail, so he turned up the heat. On May 26, he sent his petition to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As you will see in this next telephone interview, once again, the court took their time before denying his appeal.
The panel has succumbed to the cancer of corruption and the criminals in judicial robes.
It affirmed the lower court's decision denying his writ of habeas corpus, keeping him in solitary confinement in the Los Angeles County Men's Central Jail.
They have gone through and they have violated hundreds of years of established judicial precedent that a party cannot be a judge in his own case. There's no question that this particular opinion is clearly violating the Supreme Court precedent. And the Ninth Circuit is bound to follow the Supreme Court. They do not have a choice. The Ninth Circuit is buying into the corruption. So the cancer of the tyranny has now spread into the Ninth Circuit.
As the legal battle continued ponderously on, Dr. Fine began struggling with physical issues. We documented this new problem in this video. On January 5th, Mr. Fine broke his upper dental plate, making it impossible for him to chew. He attempted to have it repaired by filing an inmate complaint with the sheriff, which, like all of his court filings, was promptly and completely ignored. Hearing of his plight, Full Disclosure asked longtime ACLU supporter Ed Asner to use his influence to convince the ACLU to intercede on Mr. Fine's behalf. He generously obliged, and within the next day, the ACLU visited Mr. Fine. According to a decision by Judge Pregerson, the ACLU was contracted by Sheriff Baca to be the jail monitor for the infamous L.A. County jails, especially in regards to inmates with health problems and complaints. Their aid to Dr. Fine was underwhelming.
So basically, you know, what's come out of the ACLU at this particular point in time is zero.
In a phone call from his cell, Dr. Fine explained the response he got from the ACLU.
The ACLU, coming in as the monitoring of the health part, sending a letter and saying if nothing happens within 10 days, to call them or contact them.
Your call may be monitored or recorded
at a telephone number that is blocked.
We asked the ACLU representatives why they block calls from inmates in the jail that they are supposed to be monitoring. Did Mr. Fine tell you that he tried to reach you at the phone number that was given to him to call you?
Yeah, we talked about that. He was under the impression it accepted collect calls, and it does not, so that he had been trying to call it collect. And we don't accept collect calls right now.
So Dr. Fine took on the responsibility for himself. When Mr. Fine sent a second complaint about his broken dental plate, he was jerked around by the bureaucracy.
Yesterday, you know, what happened is that I was, I received a notice to go down to the medical department, and on the notice it said court order. And I figured, well, maybe this, the ACLU must have done something, to get a court order to have me go out and have my dental. But when I got downstairs, they told me that the court order was just meaningless. Those were just words that they used. And I had a clerk that wanted to have me sign off that we had a discussion with respect to the dental plate. And I said, well, what discussion are we having? And she said, well, sign off that we talked about this. And I said, well, we haven't talked about it. I said, what discussion? She said, well, you didn't sign a paper before. And I said, so? She said, well, sign here that you're going to sign this. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And so we never had a discussion. I said, if you wanted to tell me that we're discussing, my plate and what's going to be done about it, let's discuss that. She said, no, I'm not going to discuss that. And I said, well, did you know that the ACLU has written you? And she said, no. I said, well, maybe you ought to review your files. She said, I'm not going to do that either. I said, well, then we aren't having any discussions. She said, sign here. I said, no.
Suddenly, without a warning, a miracle happened.
This morning, at approximately, I would say, 7 o'clock this morning, the jail came to me and said that I had a pass to go to the dentist. And they came and they took me to the dentist, and all of a sudden, the dentist said that they were going to do a mold on my mouth. Now, this is the same dentist, exact same person, that told me the last time that I was there that he couldn't do anything. And would not do anything.
So apparently the deputies in the jail are doing what Judge Yaffe wanted, make Fine suffer. And only outside pressure was able to get his dental work repaired so he could eat. How long could he hold out? Why is he doing this, especially at the cost of his career, his family, and potentially his freedom for the rest of his life?
Unless we fight this corruption right now, this corruption will erode our entire governmental system. So we have to fight it now and stop it now before it erodes everything.
We're going to take another short break right now, and when we come back, we'll show you how the legal team of volunteers discovered how corrupt the court system really is. It's sad, but eye-opening. We'll be right back.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back. The reason why I played those clips for you is because I want you to understand the extent of the corruption that's going on inside this country. We got a lot of brothers and sisters out there that they're telling people that, well, I can do your documents for you. You give me $500, you give me $1,000, and I can do this. And all you got to do is just go down there and file these documents and stuff in the court. But as you can see, this is not a Moorish American going through this. This is a Caucasian. And what he has recognized is the extent of the corruption, he's uncovered the corruption, and he has taken upon himself to do the exact same thing that I'm trying to get you all to do, is to start taking responsibility for your community and start recognizing what's going on with you and the men and women in these areas. Stand up and start doing what you got to do for you. And no matter what happens, you have to remember that knowledge
is power. You cannot hope to survive without it. You got to have it. You got to have it if you hope to make any necessary changes. You're going to have to reconnect to your story. Because once you master and you have this information, anytime somebody comes along and try to sway you or turn you or try to put something in place or try to see, get you to see something from an American perspective, a sovereign perspective, or some horizontal issue, you're able to cut them off immediately and divert them to your perspective on life. But you cannot do this as a person or people who's deprived or who has no knowledge of self. You are at the mercy of not only this nation, but you are at the mercy to all corruption inside this nation. So it is very important for you to understand this and get this information under your belt so that you can survive. We're going to run through this and close it out, and then we're going to go into the next practice.
Welcome back to Full Disclosure in part one of our four-part series, The Cost of Courage, The Story of Richard I. Fine. People alarmed at the predicament of Dr. Fine began rallying to his aid. Marty Mason was the office manager and paralegal who worked for Dr. Fine for years. When she discovered what was happening to her former boss, she quickly volunteered to get all the court documents formatted and filed in proper order. She has discovered some unsettling behavior of the court in Dr. Fine's case.
I have worked on very sophisticated and complicated cases, but I have never seen any kind of situation like I'm looking at here in terms of problems with documents not even appearing in the docket. Before all of this happened, it never would have even occurred to me to question the integrity of a court docket. Now, I never will again.
A docket is an online file that shows all the relevant documents pertaining to a case. We asked her to explain what she found so disturbing.
Well, for example, in the district court case concerning disbarment, there are a total of 7 documents in the docket, but they're only identifying them by numbers 1, 3, 4, 5, and 7, meaning number 2 and number 6 are missing.
The bureaucracy was doing its best to inhibit Dr. Fine and anyone helping him. We asked her what was the effect of these documents suddenly being lost in the court.
It's making it nearly impossible. It's happened far too many times for it all to be accidental. This is the third case, not the third document, but the third case in which documents that have been filed have not shown up on the docket. And in one other instance, the missing document was used to justify striking one of his pleadings for failure to follow a certain rule, except that he had, and they knew it, but it was the only way to justify denying his habeas corpus petition. So the rules don't provide for playing hide-and-seek with legal documents, which is one reason we provide the documents ourselves on the website so at least the public can see what they contain and know what's going on and know Richard's side of the story.
As a former paralegal, Ms. Mason was disheartened by the despicable subterfuge of the court.
And it's still hard for me to accept that you can't trust the basic things to have any integrity. I have had other people make comments to me about problems with the dockets, and I kind of didn't really listen because it just didn't permeate my brain that was even remotely possible. And yet I have seen now, in the past 4 months I've been working on this, so many different examples, and they all have to do with critical documents concerning Richard's case.
The missing documents require Marty and her team to supply replacement filings, which they do without fail. But this costs Dr. Fine more time in solitary confinement.
Some of the judges meet on Mondays to consider such motions. Yes, they cost him another week in jail. This is the same case that I called them about yesterday where I got transferred to 5 different clerks looking for what happened to this motion. So I guess now it has appeared after I questioned so many people about it yesterday.
So once again, outside pressure caused the missing document to mysteriously reappear in the court docket. The system was doing its absolute best to frustrate Dr. Fine and make him suffer.
Sergeant Valdemar shared her concern about the way California justice system was treating Dr. Fine.
I mean, the basic freedoms that we enjoy, you know, all depend on our judicial system being fair and equitable. When we lose that, you know, then any one of us could wind up in Mr. Fine's position, you know, by doing something contrary to what some judge decides is proper.
We want to know what you, the viewers, think. Have you experienced this kind of arrogant abuse of power in your local court? Are you willing to do something about it? If yes, please call our Full Disclosure Town Hall number and let us know what you think at 1-800-867-7777. That's 1-800-867-7777. And if you leave your name and number, we'll get back to you. Or you can log on to our website at fulldisclosure.net and leave your opinion there. And if you leave your email address, we'll be happy to respond. I'm Leslie Dutton. Please join us for the next edition, part two, of this four-part series, The Cost of Courage, The Story of Richard I. Fine. That's coming up next on Full Disclosure. Thank you.
To respond to this question or comment on this program, please call 800-8-
Ladies and gentlemen, if you got any questions at this point, go ahead and raise your hand, and we can get them answered. But I want to add that the most powerful tool that we as African people, people of African descent, the Moors in America, for its survival is concerned, is knowledge of our own self. And I know you're tired of me saying that, and I keep saying it over and over and over. You're looking for a change. In order to make that change happen, you have to have this at the forefront of your brain. Anytime you're dealing with anybody, you're going to have to know this, because we cannot continue to go through the day-to-day activity and do nothing. We're going to have to do something and manually turn the wheel to stem the tide of our survival inside of this nation. It is vital for us to understand that. We have to do that. We're going to have to maneuver in the position to understand that knowledge is power. When we got this knowledge, and I'm not just talking about any kind of knowledge, because we have people in certain positions of authority who are trying to lead you to believe that you can receive information in the form of knowledge. No, we don't want that. We want pure, unadulterated, raw, naked knowledge about ourself, our story, and our culture. So anytime that we sit down with anybody, we're able to hold a conversation from our perspective, because that is our reality. You have to do that. That is what everybody else is doing. Everybody, when they're communicating with you, they're talking to you from their position of reality. And I don't know if I may have some new people online, but I told a story once about the lady who wanted to get an alarm system in a home, and she invited me over to sit down and talk with the man as he laid out the plans for doing the sales rep that's going to do the installation, take the order for the installation. And he was a Caucasian gentleman, and he began to tell us how the system was going to work. And I asked him, I said, well, what if we put an alarm system outside the house, so that if someone is breaking in the house, the rest of the neighbors can be alerted to the fact that somebody's breaking in the house? He told me that wasn't a good idea, because they had a case where they had did that out in this all Caucasian community, and the neighbor run over to the house next door to see what was going on, and the intruder shot him. I said, well, I'm sorry, I said, because I don't understand this. I said, we're both speaking the same language. We're both talking about the same thing. However, we're both talking to each other from two different worldviews. Number one,
when an alarm go off in our community of people of African descent, we don't run over there trying to find out what's going on. We may call the cops, but we don't do that. The only people that do something like that is people who look like you. So we have to deal with this from a whole different perspective, you see. We live in a different world. We're going to have to create all the rudiments and designs for our world. I'm only putting these past few broadcasts on here right now, these few clips on, so that you can understand the extent of the corruption, and that way you will know what you're up against and how you can shift formation.
Welcome back to Full Disclosure in part one of our four-part series, The Cost of Courage, The Story of Richard I. Fine. People alarmed at the predicament of Dr. Fine began rallying to his aid. Marty Mason was the office manager and paralegal who worked for Dr. Fine for years. When she discovered what was happening to her former boss, she quickly volunteered to get all the court documents formatted and filed in proper order. She has discovered some unsettling behavior of the court in Dr. Fine's case.
I have worked on very sophisticated and complicated cases, but I have never seen any kind of situation like I'm looking at here in terms of problems with documents not even appearing in the docket. Before all of this happened, it never would have.
When he ordered me to tell him my assets, I said, Judge, I'm not telling you my assets. I'm going to take a writ of habeas corpus against you, and I'm going to kick you out of this court. I'm going to kick you out, and I'm going to kick out every dishonest judge who has taken a bribe, and I'm going to clean up this judicial system once and for all.
Still defiant after a year in jail, Dr. Richard I. Fine was determined to win back his freedom and restore the California judicial system. How could he do this while incarcerated in solitary coercive confinement in the dreaded L.A. County Men's Central Jail? Full Disclosure took on the sheriff, fighting to interview Dr. Fine inside the jail just to find out. You've got to see what happened and what he said next on Full Disclosure.
Relentless, probing, fearless. This is Emmy Award-winning Full Disclosure with Leslie Dutton, bringing you the truth by revealing the news behind the news.
Hello, I'm Leslie Dutton. Full Disclosure has spent the better part of the last 2 years bringing to light the alarming problems with the California judicial system. Being the news behind the news, we've spent dozens of hours documenting the sinister encroachment of county governments as they move to control the local judiciary for their benefit. As you will see in this four-part series, this insidious encroachment is threatening the entire justice system, where the essence of a fair trial is being lost forever. This story of Dr. Richard I. Fine is just one account of this disturbing abuse of power. In part two, we'll show you how Full Disclosure submitted a request to the Los Angeles County Sheriff, Leroy Baca, to take our cameras into the Men's Central Jail to interview Dr. Fine. We wanted to verify that he was all right and to show the viewers how he had fared during his first year in jail. Our request got the same response that Dr. Fine got with all his petitions. Our request was summarily denied.
Hi, Leslie. This is Steve Whitmore. I am unfortunately the bearer of bad news. The sheriff has repeatedly told me that that will not happen, and so your request has been denied. And he has not. I just talked to him yesterday about this, and he said it again. He said, no, that's not going to happen. So it's not going to happen, Leslie, and I'm sorry to have to deliver that to you, but that is what the sheriff's decision is, and it's his discretion. And I know that is bad news, and I'm sorry for that, but that is a final decision.
Like Dr. Fine, Full Disclosure doesn't roll over when government bureaucrats say no. We contacted our associates at Judicial Watch. With their help, we filed suit against Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. After a month of wrangling, we were finally allowed to go inside the Los Angeles Central Men's Jail with our cameras to interview Dr. Fine. We asked Sheriff Spokesman Steve Whitmore to explain the sudden change in policy.
No, not
and
you.
That may not be fair to him.
Yes.
I'd like you to explain what led up to his changing his mind.
The process of changing his mind was the fact that we had a visit one day, and I suggested to him, why don't we just let her do it with the camera? And he said, okay, let's do it. I know that sounds simple, and I know that you think maybe there's more machinations, if you will, that went into the decision, but that was the decision.
Lawson didn't have a thing to do with it.
Not with the sheriff, no, not at all. Obviously, logic dictates when you take an action like that, it comes to the forefront of everybody's attention. But the sheriff didn't seem to be, I don't know if he was interested, I think he's a curious man, so he was interested, but no, but it wasn't, he said to me specifically, because I said, that's great, let's do it, but you know what, maybe I should talk to the attorneys. I said that, because I'm not very smart. And he said, that has nothing to do with my decision. Let her interview Richard Fine. He needs to make sure he signs the waivers, which he did. And he said, Steve, I want you there. So I was there. If there was a sense, or even because of me saying this is not going to happen, I should have been, that falls on my shoulders. That shows on my inability to explain that, Leslie, he doesn't want you to come in with the camera. And I think I did say that, but I should have said it clearer, and I didn't. And then he changed his mind. If the question is, Steve, you said this wasn't going to happen definitively, and then it did happen, and understandably you're saying, what happened in the middle? What changed it? That's what changed it. Was this is presumptuous of me to say that I changed it, because I don't. He is the sheriff, and we should be fair to him. It is his decision, and he said, yes, let's let her do it.
So we did it. We sat down with Dr. Fine and asked him to tell us what happened over the last year. He explained a progression of coercion.
I was then put into a private cell, solitary confinement cell, and I was in that cell for a number of days. And then I was moved into the Twin Towers, and I was put, for some reason or another, under suicide watch. And under the suicide watch, I was given a type of a gown. It was a heavy type of a gown that had the sort of a tape on the side of it, no other garments. And I was in suicide watch for approximately a week to a week and a half. Now, the interesting thing about this, and that no reason for suicide watch whatsoever. I mean, I'm not suicidal or anything else. And in that particular area, they don't, when they give you your meals, they don't even give you any utensils with which to eat. So you're basically eating with your hands. I was in that suicide watch for the period of time. I did not have any type of a shower or anything else for approximately, I think it was about a week before I was allowed to take my first shower. And then I was able to use the telephone, you know, once or twice, a few times during that period of time.
Former Los Angeles Sheriff Deputy Richard Valdemar had worked with the LA jails early in his career. He underscored the torment that suicide watch creates for inmates.
You know, I've never met Mr. Fine myself personally. I've heard him speak on videotape and read articles about him. But he never seemed to me to be mentally incompetent of going through the procedure and being held in a jail setting. I mean, it's a tough situation for anyone, but I don't see that he would be that weak that, you know, he might commit suicide. There are people, of course, who have a real bad reaction to confinement and do become very depressed and suicidal. Hopefully he was evaluated by a mental health professional before that was done. But I have seen that occur when the officers themselves have a feeling that this might occur. Somebody becomes suicidal. Frankly, though, without some information showing that there was a risk to his life and safety, it's offensive to me that would be done to any man. It smacks of Russia, you know, who often use their mental institutions to house people who are politically incorrect. It's offensive to me.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll show you how Dr. Fine continued his fight against the system while incarcerated in solitary coercive confinement. We'll be right back.
Turn a gray sky blue. You see, I can make it rain when I want it to.
Oh, I
can build a castle from a single grain of sand.
Yeah.
You see, I can make a ship sail on dry land, children, yeah. Unhappy am I with all the power that I possess, yeah. Key to my happiness, and I'm
hanging next to you,
baby.
Ooh, Lord. Hanging next to you.
I've been traveling long time.
Hanging next to you.
Now, not getting along, I want to let you know, is a luxury. You don't get along, it's a luxury. And there are several things required for you to have the luxury of not getting along and with fussing and fighting with your mate. It requires you to have a stable source of income for food and shelter, because you ain't worried about what you're going to eat, where you're going to sleep. You got that, so I got time to fuss. It requires for you to be in pretty good health, because you got to have strength to bring up all that negativity. You got to have strength to do that. You got to be able to take a stand. So, you know, you have to be able to do that. And it requires us to think that we have options. You know, men, women, they like a bus. Miss one, catch another. Well, I got news for y'all. That train has already left the station. It's not like that was. And it requires that we think that we have time. We can mess up, start all over, mess up, apologize, and this will just go on forever. We don't have that time anymore. What we have is just some basic major relationship problems, and they have been the same ones that we have had for the last 134 years. We 17 generations up from slavery, and many of our problems remain the same. I have a book called Are You Still a Slave? It's a test book. It lets you take a test and answer certain questions to determine how much of a slave are you still acting like even without a slave master. Since they put this into us, it's a lot of stuff we just on automatic. And we're the first people to say, well, you know, that's just how I feel. No, it's not. These are things that they bred, they put into us. And they certainly put into us not to get along with each other. That makes them the winner. In every civilization, on every continent, among every mammal, when the female mammal has to forage for food, fight and protect the nest, bear the children alone, and do all of those things, it makes her naturally hostile to the male mammal. Because she feels abandoned. Well, we have abandonment issues. It makes many of our men feel entitled. Entitled to do anything they want to do, and we're supposed to go along with it. They put a lot of confusion into us that have made us bring that confusion even down into the world, into our children. And we have set them up for failure in their relationships. Because they're not doing what we tell them, they're doing what they see. And if they don't see us getting along, if they don't see our men respecting our women, they don't see our women respecting our men, then this is what they're going to practice. We have a problem with fidelity and jealousy. That's really, you know, we have a problem about lying. We especially charge our men with lying. That's a serious thing, this lying issue. We want y'all, when we ask you a question, we want y'all to testify. We want the truth and nothing but the truth. So help you, I'm gonna nag you forever about it. So this is something that we do to try to get to it. You know, we say, well, if you had just told me you didn't want to be with me no more, then I could have handled it. That's a lie. Don't no man in here need to believe that. Okay? That is never going to be the truth. I mean, what is our man supposed to do? Say, listen, baby, I done met somebody I like better than you. We have better sex than me and you. She got a good job. She got a car. She ain't got but one child. And so I don't want to be with you no more. How is that going to go over? Well, we're going to say, well, yes, listen, thank you, brother. I'm glad you told me. You know? Position where he can't bring the truth, and then when you all tell us a lie, then we get very angry because we want you to testify. Now, testify was a word that used to be used in the Roman courts, and if a man wanted to tell the truth about something, then he would swear on his testicles. Now, we know the last thing y'all gonna do is to swear on those. Okay? So perhaps sometime our expectation about some of these things might be a little bit outrageous because we have so many insecurities. You know, if you go outside the door, where you going, when you be back, who you going to be with? How long you going to be gone? Who you going to be standing with? How much money you going to spend? Who did you see? Well, what happened while you was there? What did he say? You know, we better than the FBI. And that's an unreal expectation. You know, see, there are a lot of, you know, lofty ideas that we can talk about relationships, but we have to deal with some basic principles that we still haven't got straight. And people tell me all the time when I go out, they say, you know, I really like that sister because she's down to earth. Well, hey, we live on the earth. This is where we have to be, down to this earth. This is the only planet we got life on that we know of. We live right here on this earth. And these are earthen issues that we are dealing with. And as sisters, we need to, this is a really serious issue. We need to stop going so crazy and berserk if we find out that perhaps our man has made a mistake or did it intentionally, was with another woman. I mean, it's not like you alone. Every one of us women in here done had a man that was with somebody else. Because there ain't no such man that's going to be with no one woman for his entire 75-year life. Now, that's the reality that we're dealing with. That ain't the one we want to deal with. But that's the reality of it. It's no such man. If it was such a man, me and my sister Killer would have him. So we have searched for that mystery guy, and he does not exist. And that doesn't mean that it's taking anything from you or me. It's not even about that. It's about the nature of us as two different people. Now, that's a personal decision, of course, that men make, but I'm just want to let the sisters know that's nothing we have to be ashamed of. Our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, our mothers, us, everybody. We ain't never had no woman that had a man that wasn't never with nobody else. It doesn't exist. It is called, the messenger said, the imagination of truth. And it will get you in trouble with such great disappointment. You don't have to be ashamed. You're not telling nobody that ain't never heard of it. You know, say that point going out, burning his clothes, tearing up his car, messing up everything that you didn't have to pay for, and then when you get over being mad, you're going to be back with him. So we need to not do that. It's just a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. And it gives us setbacks. Like I say, it's a luxury. You don't know when the last time is going to be. And you lose someone that really, really is dear to you and someone that you love. Now, the second problem we have is about some of our men don't have no job. Now, that's a real issue because we need money. We want money, you know. Now, you know, last year we spent about $13 billion on our fingernails. So we could probably do with a little less money. We spent another $23 billion on our hair. $10 billion of that was on our fake hair. Okay. So we, you know, have spent money. But we have a problem sometimes if a man can't afford to do those things for us. And, you know, there's a lot of people living in the world that make $200 a year. If some people don't make the $75 a month, they still there. They not eating like we eating and everything. They not overweight either. They don't have diabetes and everything we got. But nevertheless, there are people who live with much less than we do. And certainly we all want to have a man who has a visible means of legal support. Okay? We all want to have that. But we can't completely judge our men by the same standard that the white woman judge her man, because her man ain't never been repressed. Okay? Many of our men are out of work because they're just too depressed or they can't work or don't want to work. And then you got a lot of our men who are out of work because the white people in charge of the jobs won't give them an opportunity or a job. This is not magic. And then they'll give more to us, and then we start tripping and start thinking, I don't know why you can't get no job. I got one. It's not like that. With many of us, we take the position with our man where any job is better than no job. But that's not the position of a man. Men take the position where no job is better than any job. They have a different standard. They have a different ego. And no matter what we think we can feel and experience, we do not know what it's like to be a black man in America. We the little tiny glimpse that I got almost make me want to cry all day, because it's so unfair to our man. And the best success that this country can have is to use us as a tool against the black man. They're already against him. See, they protected their woman for all those years. If you mess with a white woman at one time, they would kill you. They protected her. But see, ain't nobody never protected us. And so being free for all out here, they have felt that it was okay for them to be able to come in and give us the things that they keep our men from giving us so that they can be our man. And we even call him the man. I'm going to call the man. Yeah, the man called him. Well, we're talking about the white man. But you are man. And we need to return that title to him. We need to try to be more respectful. Even if he don't respect himself, we need to try to respect him. That's a hard instruction. Because we know things. But that we really have to practice that. We really have to try to practice just how to be respectful, since we know that he's not the only damaged goods. We damage goods too. It doesn't mean it necessarily has to hold us back, but we do live in a society where we have more opportunities and more benefits. All we have to do is get pregnant, and the white man will give us a house, a place to live in, health insurance, pharmacy coverage, daycare, food stamps, rent coverage, and everything else. A black man can't get nothing unless he done lost his job. He can get some unemployment for a while. But since most of y'all ain't even had no job, you eliminated from that access. So it's not fair. It really is not right how it's set up. And I want you to understand that. And so those things keep us from wanting to be with a man, because we say he ain't got nothing. Well, we wouldn't have nothing either if they weren't trying to use us against him. It don't make us greater and better because we have been able to make a little bit of progress, because we've had more support out here. Because they want to own our children. They want to make us totally dependent upon them. This hasn't changed. We haven't got that modern where that don't exist no more. We have to stop looking at our men as sex objects. Now that's a turn, isn't it? That's how come you have so many sisters that's disappointed, because the only time they get along with their man is when they laying down. Once the man stand up, we don't want to be in it no more. He might tell us what to do or something. All bets are off. That's the deal breaker when you start trying to tell me what to do. We have to look at it. We have to stop using our men like that. You know, when a rat get ready to mate, the female rat go and sniff around the male rat. She makes sure, first of all, that he don't have any imperfections so that she can get pregnant. He can't have polio. He can't have diabetes, high blood pressure. He can't have heart disease or none of that, or she don't deal with him. And the second thing he has to do is to be able to go someplace and make a nest for her. If he don't have a home for her, if he can't dig a hole somewhere for her, then she says, I can't be with you. I'm going to find me another rat. Okay? So it's not unreasonable if the female rat can practice that. It's not unreasonable for us as black women to require that. No, I can't get pregnant because you ain't got nowhere for me and the baby to sleep. Okay? No, I can't get pregnant because tomorrow I might be hungry. And you ain't got no food for me. What are we going to eat? That's important. So we can require that. So we need to, when we see a brother and he's down, leave him there. Because if you pick him up and drag him up, he's going to leave you the first chance he gets. Because he want to be around somebody who thinks he was always up. That's how that works. You can't make no man. You can't get with no man who ain't got nothing and buy him some shoes, buy him a coat and a hat, and then when you get mad, want to take it back. You can't buy no man. If you want to make a man, you have to do it with your own son, your nephew, your cousin, a boy in the community. You can take a little child and try to grow him up, but you can't take no grown man and turn him into a man. That's a waste of time. And any investment you make, you will fail. That's just the truth of that. And it's going to be hard because they be needing so much. Show up, ain't got no underwear, ain't got no socks. Just whatever it is, okay? Leave them alone. He'll get some. I guarantee you, he'll get some if he want to be with you. We set the standard. And if there ain't no standard, then he don't live up to nothing. Because they want to be with us, whatever it costs, whatever it takes, they want to be with us. But if we make that so simple, and so easy that no matter what, we'll just accept that and go along and, you know, just to go to bed with him. You know, in your entire life, you only spent about 2.5 hours having a climax. That's all total. Whatever you done told yourself, it's a lie. 2.5 hours. Okay? So that little bit of time is not as important as all the other aspects of the relationship. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Don't nobody break up over sex. People break up over issues like you didn't close the bathroom door. You didn't put the seat down. I'm tired of sweeping the floor. How come you don't help me fold the clothes? Anything. We break up over that. You come in too late. Well, where's the rest of your money? How come you gave your mama some money? I mean, we... you know, we'll break up over all of those kind of things. We don't break up over sex. So it's a value, but it's not the value that we have placed on it. It's not the only thing to do. You have to have something to talk about, some kind of aspirations, some kind of goal. And you might even need to have good credit. That's the new criteria now. I don't want to see your HIV card. I want to see your credit report. Now, if we just base it on that, we know ain't none of us going to be together. We may as well not even try to have a relationship if it's going to be based on credit. Because we just found out about that. We've been there 135 years. It's only been 2 years that we've been learning anything about a credit report. Nobody never taught us about no credit. But this is where we are. We got to look at where we are and stop tripping, pretending we someplace else because that's where white people are or because that's where they set the standard. We got to start where we are to make the change and to make an improvement. It has to be what we are doing. And raising our children, that's an issue. Over 60% of the black babies in Philadelphia are aborted. That's probably very similar here in D.C. because this is a nationwide phenomenon. White people trying to have babies, we're trying to kill ours. Now, there's simple remedies for some of that. If you don't want to have no baby, don't get pregnant. Don't have unprotected sex. Now, many of our young girls now are using abortion as birth control. They have 5 and 6, 7 in a year. We have so many unwed mothers. And we have something that's never talked about. We have so many unwed fathers. Because it still does take the two people. We do not have an immaculate conception among black people. It's the men and the women that make the baby. We have to deal with how we're rearing our children. We have to stop trying to give them everything we think we didn't have as a child. You want to make peace with somebody, buy it, make it with yourself. Don't use the child like that and confuse them. so that they grow up thinking that they are what they own. And you're not what you own. You're who you are. It has nothing to do with what some white people and some Asians made, because everything we got comes from them. So we can't let that be the standard of who, you know, we think that we are. It was a merry-go-round we used to have our children on, but now this thing is moving so fast, it's like a roller coaster. We can't keep up. We can't teach them that the brand name clothes is more important than a math test. We can't neglect the children in the name of I'm working to take care of you. Those things have to go hand in hand. And it's almost better if you let your child sit with his daddy on the curb, who ain't got no job, then we as women keep sitting in the house talking about we can raise a boy alone. We can feed them alone and clothe them alone, but we can't raise them alone. We don't know how to make no man, or all of us would have a man. So we know we got some kind of problem up in there in that area of trying to deal with, you know, how we gonna get along or be with a man. And then we see a lot of grown men, and we'll go out with them, we say, you know what, I ain't going out here no more. He is so silly. Well, he didn't get grown and get silly. He was silly when he was a little boy, and didn't nobody interfere and interrupt and help him. So we have to take a position that, okay, if we're going to be a mother, then we can deal with our girls. And everybody in America see the condition, mostly black girls. And we're big girls. And they're not in good condition, most of them. We've gotten waylaid with a lot of material things. We've gotten waylaid with sex. They've whipped us into a frenzy with this whole sexual thing. That's the total goal. And we got it all mixed up. And as a result of that, we're not making the relationship legacy that we want to make for the future. We're not showing the image that we want our children and grandchildren to see so they can go out and act like that. You know, what we're doing is not good. And we also, on this argument thing, we have to let our men win some of the arguments. I know that sounds painful. But it's okay to let him win sometime. All you got to do is grit your teeth and say, that's right, baby. You're right. Okay. We ain't got to win every argument. You can be right, and you'll be right by yourself. Don't be right all the time. There's no winner in that. You know, we don't give them an opportunity. Men, a father is not another mother. He's not going to discipline the child, talk to the child, or deal with him like we do. And every time our man try to say something different or teach or tell the child something different, we got to protect him. Oh, no, don't you deal with him like that. And then when he go up and have an identity crisis, by the time he's about 12 or 13 and out of hand, then we want to call the father and say, you better come and get him. See, this thing is repetitive. This is not just going on today. This is what's been going on for the past 50 years since the oncoming of new black millionaires, of the material items and the technology advancing where you have all these material things. All of that has created that for us so that we're not even real with the people that we be with. We manufacture some kind of personality so when we meet somebody, we can think we're somebody else. And so, and then after about 60 days when the sexual attraction wear off and you start meeting that real person, you decide, I don't like them at all. Who is that? Who are you? You know. Listen, baby, you're going to have to go. Because this is how it works. It's more lies told in the first 2 and 3 weeks of any relationship than at any other time in your life. Now, you're talking about some humongous lies, some gigantic misrepresentations about what you got, who you are, what you drive, where you work, what your history is, everything. We just lie because we want to be make a good impression, and we want to be accepted and admired. We don't deal with the truth that you can't maintain that. Pretty soon it's going to be, baby, can I get some gas money or something? Something is going to come up that we will know that it's not the truth. This is our life. This is our life. This is what we live in. And the reason I can tell you these things is because they go on in all our house. We think something different going on in everybody's house. No, it's not. The same nonsense is going on in everybody's house. It's not different. You think you're different. It ain't different. It's the same. It's not different. Which is why we need a group solution to help us to start working on something. It's not to go out and join the organization. It's not to go, you know, get in this club or group. You got to start where you at. You got to start at home, at the person you're looking at. Whether it's your family, whether it's your man, your woman, whomever, start trying to get along with them before you come out here in the street going to protest something to help somebody else get along. Sometimes we go out, we can't even make it back in the car from a protest. We be fighting and arguing in. This hypocrisy. Yeah, we all go in some kind of mass hypnosis and pretend it's not going on. It's going on, and it is destroying us year after year after year. See, we have one thing in common. We have a shared ancestral slave history. But we can't get away from that. We have come through the same thing. It's in us genetically. All our fears, our insecurities, our hatred, hatred of self, hatred of anybody that looked like us. All of that was bred into us. And so when those things come up, we have to be able to fight against it and say, no, I'm not going to do that because I know that's what they want me to do. I'm going to take a little bitty step. I'm going to try to just do something different. I'm going to try to do for self some kind of way. And sisters, we have to take our hearts, as I said, because I'm mentioning this again because this is so important. We have to take our heart out of our vagina. Okay?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of the broadcast. We're coming back with part three of Moore's Relationships and Men and Women. We'll be doing that at Weekend's End, so I need you all to tune in to that. And I hope you all have gotten something out of this broadcast. And keep in mind that Thursday evening, the Grand National Chairman for the Moorish American Government will be with us, and we will be dropping some very, very extraordinary information. So we need you to be here with us. I've been your host, Haka Amana L. Bain. Until the
is something that I'm missing?
From loving me.